Hi, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Dr. Harris Black Lives Matter Show. I am hosting this show tonight along with Aileen Reed.
Hi, everybody.
And we have a special guest. We have a couple of special guests. The one is Tony Bullock.
Good evening, everyone.
And our founder who will come in, founder of the Dr. Harris Black Lives Matter Show, who will come in just a minute and chime in on the topic tonight. So tonight's topic is releasing a chokehold on Black families and youth. First of all, I do want to start with just saying that I'm just glad to, you know, be here, be amongst friends, and to be also having this platform provided by Dr. Harris to speak and talk and dialogue and try to bring knowledge to one another so we can get the ball rolling and start doing the things we need to do in the community to heal our community and rebuild.
Yeah.
So I just need to put that out there first. So last week
we talked about
Black love.
It was really eye-opening because I really like the way Sister Maria put it in the context of not just love between a man and a woman, but a love between you, an individual and the community. It could be the individual and their church. So what does Black love look like? And we talked about that, and we had a lot of people listening and calling in and making comments about that show. So good on you, Sister Maria, for choosing that subject, because this is sort of like we started with the Black Superwoman,
mm-hmm.
then we talked about who was Black Superman, and then we talked about Black love. So so now we've gotten to where we are tonight, talking about releasing the chokehold on the Black community, Black youths in particular.
Yeah,
so,
our families and youth.
Our families.
So we always start with a little history, you know, behind the subject matter. So we talked about slavery and how it dismantled not only the Black family, but it also tried, it did, we in the Black man,
right.
increase the woman's role in what she had to do because of these handcuffs, these chokeholds. That were put on the Black man,
exactly.
Which greatly affected the Black family.
Yes.
And we have to emphasize the man because in order for them to target the man and go after him, they had to know that he held a key and that he was the factor in dominating and oppressing a people for 3 centuries plus.
Absolutely. Because I think people get the wrong idea sometimes that the Black matriarch that she's portrayed in literature and media is something that the Black woman necessarily, you know, relished and sought. And that is not always true. This was something that was put upon her, shoved upon her, and she had to pick up that mantle in order to keep moving her family forward so far as being alive. And so it built up some resentment, you know, not just between other women of other colors, but, you know, sometimes with Black men who thought the Black woman had it easier. She just had it different. She didn't have it easier.
Well, if you look at history, the way things have always been targeted is if you take out the men, you weaken the structure of that particular group of people.
Mm.
You think back to when the Egyptians were running things, okay? Let's attack the Hebrews. First thing they do is they take out the men children. They take out the men. Therefore, the women are supposed to be helpless and, you know, without guidance. So we can come in and just take over. The same thing happened with here in the U.S. with slaves and with the Indians. You take out the men. Therefore, the women will be helpless. We can come in and take over the culture and do as we see fit. which now leads you to today. When welfare came along, it was like, hey, you really need a man to take care of you. Let the government do it for you and keep that man out of your household.
And we'll control,
which is what has been happening for decades and generations. Okay, we'll keep the man out and let us provide for you. But while providing for you, we're going to keep you within a certain parameter. So stay in there and don't try to go any further, and we'll be all right.
But by the same token, they also wanted to denigrate the Black family and say, oh, well, you have a missing father figure, you have a missing husband, so therefore the woman must be promiscuous.
Exactly.
You know, the man must be shipless, and so on and so forth. And so one of the great things about
brutality,
right.
and Black and brown youth, and that chokehold, and we know it has led to death, and but it's not just that chokehold. We have other chokeholds, the justice system being a chokehold, you know, incarceration being a chokehold,
poor school,
low
level jobs, you know, self-hatred and and the mismanagement of what they call Christianity, which was used to further enslave us in a way. So the chokehold is both visible and visceral, and where you can't see it, but it impacts our lives every day. We were just talking just before the show started about how in many African-American communities, you have liquor stores on every corner or every other corner. And that is not something that you see. You have all these liquor stores, but you don't have places to buy fresh fruits and vegetables.
Exactly.
And, you know, we want to know why. We want to know the reason why.
Yes.
So
the chokehold and the family. So one of the questions, I'd like to start with questions because they help us process and think and explore and throw out different ideals and so forth. So the first question is, what are the chokeholds preventing our youth from leading healthy and productive lives, free of gang involvement and violent crimes? So I do have a couple of guests that are coming on. And when they come on, they're going to speak a little more to the gang lifestyle. What's appealing about it? Why is it pulling our youth? And what can we do? I mean, if there's a problem, then there's a solution to it.
Exactly.
So we want to explore solutions. It's not good enough just to feed into these private prisons and, you know, and keep them thriving and think that we can't take back our communities and we can't take back our families and that we can't take back our youth. It's very false to think that we're helpless and hopeless and unable to accomplish that. But we also know that it's going to take work. It's going to take unity. And it's going to take us being role models and us modeling healthy behaviors, healthy relationships, and how we talk to each other, how we treat each other, how we work together. So these are just some of the things that we know would have to go into reaching out to our youth and get. They are our future. You know, everybody has a die date. As well as you have a date that you're born, you're going to have a date that you die.
Exactly.
And part of leaving this earth is leaving a legacy, leaving something for the next generation to build on, teaching them, passing the torch, not just holding on to the torch until the torch just die out, you know, pass the torch. and train our youth and teach our youth.
Exactly.
But it's not just as simple as saying, let's just come together and train our youth and teach our youth. And that's the challenge
right.
in finding solutions. It's not always a clear-cut
right.
solution.
And the challenge is actually putting what you say into work.
Yes.
Because we can sit all day long and say, well, we know that we need to reach our youth and we know we need to do that. It's no good if all we do is keep saying this is what we need to do, but you got to put those actions into work.
Absolutely.
You have got to make it happen, because if you don't, we have failed another group of children.
Well, we have a blueprint. We have blueprints.
Right, right.
I was listening to KPA on the way over here, and they were talking about the Black Panthers and how they started the food program, the breakfast program,
right.
and the shoe giveaway
the
program,
shoe giveaway
and
program.
The grocery, you know, and all these things, the health clinics that they started.
Right.
And so the Panthers were a threat to America because we were in the middle of a Cold War. People are trying to figure out, well, people have all these needs, and the Panthers are meeting these needs. Why is the government doing this?
Exactly.
They didn't wait on the government. They did it in the same way that their grandparents and their great-grandparents came together, many of them through their church groups or their ladies or fraternal orders or whatever. But the Panthers got it done. So what I'm saying all this to say, got a blueprint. We
right,
don't have
right.
to start from yeah. scratch and reinvent the wheel. We just have to do it.
Yes.
And like Bertoni said, stop talking about it and just get it done.
Get it done. So we have, I'm expecting a few call-in guests. So I'm going to bring one in and see who this is, because I don't have a name that pops up. So last four numbers, 2680. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi, Maria. This is Christina from California Youth Outreach.
Hi, Christina. Thank you for calling in.
You're welcome.
So we
are
introductory. So can you just introduce what yourself and what you do and your background?
Sure. So my name is Christina Yee. I'm with California Youth Outreach, and our agency has been working with gang-involved youth for well over 30 years, and oh, what else to say? Oh, well, so we currently provide services in Santa Clara County. We provided services here in Fresno and in Salinas and in Santa Rosa. And
wow.
so we provide a variety of services, including working with adults and youth that are coming out of incarceration and trying to get reestablished in their community. We've had street outreach programs. We've provided cognitive behavioral intervention groups for youth that are incarcerated. So we just do a little bit of everything, but mainly targeting individuals that are impacted by gangs.
Wow. That's wonderful.
Okay, okay. And you were saying that you reach out to youth that have been impacted by gangs. Are these when they first come out, are these services available for them, or do they have to wait a specific amount of time?
You know, the evidence-based model is that reentry services are most effective on the first day that an individual is incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really have to agree with that, because when an individual is incarcerated, you know, you really have them as a captive audience where you can really work with them, figure out, sometimes they need time to figure out how they got where they're at,
right.
what they want to work on while they're incarcerated, and what they want to do when they get out. And
wow.
so building that relationship with them while they're incarcerated really helps to build a trusting relationship so that when they are back in the community, you're going to have a better chance that you're going to be able to work with them and they'll follow through on some of the goals that they spoke about when they were incarcerated.
Okay.
So, Chris, we were just getting into the family, you know, how the family is often the key to helping young folks avoid gangs or just certain criminal behaviors. So I worked with you. You were my supervisor. Awesome. Experience. That was probably the most experienced and knowledgeable group of folks that I worked with doing gang intervention. And I really loved my time working with you guys. Taught me a lot. So one thing we were talking about, you mentioned something in a post yesterday. Yesterday I did a post asking, name three things that could keep you from joining gangs. And we got a lot of great feedback, and I'm going to read some of those comments a little later in the show. But one thing you said is really servicing the entire family. Mm-hmm. And you just touched on some of that when you talked about it starts the first day. It starts with making that connection with them while they're doing the time. So can you just expand on what is servicing the whole family? What does that look like?
Well, I think that anytime you have a client, especially a youth that's involved in gangs, you know, when you think about the reasons why they would join gangs, you know, some of them join because it's an opportunity to make money. Some of them join for protection and safety. Some join because, you know, they have a poor use of their leisure time. Some join because they need this sense of belonging to be fulfilled. So when I think of just some of those reasons, I can't help but see, and then through experience hear, you know, a lot of kids that, you know, there's obviously something that's lacking in their life. And I think that, you know, and you'll probably recall some of the experience that we had together working in the parenting program, is that, you know, when you see these kids and you get to know them and hear about their family life, come to find out that their parents have a lot of things that they're dealing with, which I think they don't intentionally create that void for their kids. But when you think about, you know, single parents that are financially struggling, that, you know, they're fighting to put food on the table and they're working two jobs, well, kids can see that as, hey, my parents aren't here, you know, maybe I'll go out and make some money because there's never any money here in the house. You know, so they go and join a gang, and the gang really becomes their family, you know, lacking what they're getting from their parents, you know. So I think when you meet a kid, or in my experience, when I have met, you know, youth clients, their parents are just in need of supportive services and resources as well, not just financially, but you have parents that are dealing with their own trauma. They're struggling to maintain control of their kids because they can't be home 24/7 because maybe they're working or you know, sometimes they're just mentally or emotionally checked out because of dealing with their own trauma. Right. Some of them lack parenting skills. Some of them lack support from family members or friends.
Some of them are dealing with... This is Eileen. When you were talking about the parents dealing with their own trauma, I wanted to ask you about drug and alcohol usage. And I don't want it to seem like this is our normal pathologies that we're dealing with people of color or gang members. But is that sometimes a factor where the parents check out?
Absolutely.
And if so, do you all have a way to assist them in getting better into recovery?
So, absolutely. I think to answer your question, I think that we encounter that there is a lot of drug abuse. Again, because they're dealing with their own trauma, they've never received counseling? Because let's face it, it's not in our culture. You know, I'm Hispanic, I'm Mexican. You don't go to an outside party to talk about your issues within your family or what you experience. You know, I'm sure that all cultures have certain ideas about therapy and talking about those things that people don't normally talk about, you know. So, yeah, I would say that, yeah, there's a lot of addictive behavior, you know. And to help families or to help the parents, I think that the way that we do that is, I know that our agency, we tend to hire a lot of our staff that are that have that lived experience and that have turned their life around or recovered or were exposed to that lifestyle. So just by their sheer life experience, they resources and they can help parents and support them through that because it takes one to know
That's very forward thinking of your agency. Thank you for your answer. Wow, that's cool.
Yes, so you mentioned parenting, and that brings us back to the family. And a lot of times you do better when you know better or know more. And so what are those fundamental things? What are our couple of fundamental things that you, in your experience, that you've seen that really, if instilled in the family, it really strengthens the family?
Well, so I've been a family wellness instructor and a train the trainer for probably over 10 years now. And one of the things that I see over and over again that that intervention workers struggle with their families is setting rules and being the parents. I think that you know, your kids don't come with an instructional manual. And I think individuals as parents, we tend to take on our parents' parenting style. So I know that in my own experience, I will catch myself doing or saying some of the same things that my mother or my father did when they were raising me, and vowing never to do the same thing, but because that is all I know, or that was all that I knew, I ended up repeating that same pattern. So I think if you don't have parent education, then, you know, you forget or you're not reminded about parents being in charge. And I think when you lack those parenting skills and those fundamental things, you tend to want to be your child's friend and not their parent. You know? And I think that parents have a lot of good intentions, but I think that it really blurs the line for the kids. And you know, you want to be their friend, but then when it's time to be a parent and time to discipline them or guide them, you know, that line gets very blurry. And I think that's where a lot of parents make that mistake. You know, kids don't take them serious, or, you know, they don't listen to them as a parent because they're And the other thing I see parents lacking is consistency, you know. It's hard. It's hard to be consistent with your kids, you know. Whenever you discipline your kids and you want to ground them or if you want to, you know, restrict them, you know, in order to maintain that consistency, sometimes parents have to be in lockdown with their kids too, right? So I think it's hard for parents to follow through because that means that, you know, if you ground your kids and they're teenagers and you say, well, you have to stay home, Well, in order to enforce that, sometimes you got to be there right along with them. And
like you on punishment, well, you put the kid on punishment.
Yeah, right. And so parents sometimes they either are unable to, because again, you know, they could be working, or there could be other obstacles that would prevent them from doing that. Or sometimes they just, you know, they just give up. You know, they can't follow through with it for whatever reason, you know.
Right.
And so then I think the kids, it's really hard when a parent will threaten a kid to say, well, I'm going to ground you, and then not follow through, you know. After a while, kids, they're not going to really believe anything you say, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think those are the two probably the main mistakes that I think parents make. So they really need to follow through and be consistent and be their parent and not their kids.
Absolutely.
Or not their friends. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Well, I grew up in the family. That's how they was.
I love that because I see the same type of struggles. So, you know, I always like something that we can begin today or implement today, even if it's a small step. And our overall a thing that we're trying to accomplish is to start changing the narrative. But in order to change the narrative, we also have to educate, train, teach.
Right.
And so we understand, you know, what's pulling us down and what's dismantling the family.
And the
root of those things. So could you give us just one thing that if a household or parent, they could implement it today or as soon as they wake up?
So it's going to sound really odd to a lot of people, but one of the things that they can do is they can start having, I suggest dinner. They can start having dinner or at least one family meal together. You know, everybody's got to eat, right?
Yeah.
You're going to
eat,
so why not sit there and have dinner with your kids and have a conversation with them?
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of research that's available on a number of different sites, parenting sites, and there's been a lot of research around having family dinners with your kids and how it reduces the likelihood that they're going to abuse drugs or smoke or, you know, just do a lot of those gateway activities, you know, those things that lead up to, you know, bigger and better things in the, you know, criminal world, if you will. But that's the one thing that I always say is like, start by having dinner with your kids at least once a week. Can you do that? And then gradually increase it, you know?
Wow.
It doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be, you could
formal.
Buy it. You can make it. Yeah.
That's
Everybody's got to eat. It's the one thing that you can do. And to start having conversations with your kids, you know, check in, you know? And I think that the more that you see your kids, you know, the more you're going to be more in tune with their body language, you know. Look at them, you know. Do they look troubled? Are they not acting the same? You know, are they high? Are they drunk? You know, when you see a person every day, you know if something is not right, you know, just by looking at them, you know.
Right.
And sometimes in the busyness of our everyday activities, we miss it, you know. We miss those subtle signs, you know. So I think if you sit there and you have a meal together, you know, you can kind of, you'll at least have that half an hour or whatever to kind of check in with them, you know.
Yeah, so like a family, it's like a family check-in, but it's while we're eating, while we're doing something that we all have to do.
Mm-hmm, exactly, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I love it. I love what you had to say and some of the advice. You could definitely stay on the call if you'd like. I'm going to bring another caller in that's going to talk a little bit about the breakdown in the family. So feel free to stay on the call if you like. But if you have to leave, I understand also. And just tell your family they the best. Please tell them that I said hello, and I miss them. That was probably the best experience I've had. I haven't learned so much in such a short time anywhere else, to be honest.
Well, we loved having you, and I'm glad to hear that you're still involved in that important work.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Caller 2501. Hi, caller 2501. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Hi, Maria.
Hi. Is this Celeste?
Yes.
Hey, thank you for calling in.
Finally.
I know. We were about 4 minutes behind, so thank you for being patient.
It's okay. Yeah. I really like hearing the previous caller. I wasn't able to get her name. I was going through some technical stuff on my computer trying to hook up to the program. So I just got on my phone and I just kind of figured it out. But what she touched on some very important. She made some very important points. And the one thing that which was in her last comment, the one thing I wanted to remind the people in Fresno of is that we have a day dedicated to the family. And that happened, I think it was back in 2007, when Cynthia Sterling was the chair for district. And so I had recently moved to California, and there is a day in September dedicated to Family Day. And Family Day, it says that if you sit down and you have dinner with your family at least once a week, it'll keep the children from becoming involved in drugs and alcohol and smoking. And so we actually have a day dedicated to that. We just haven't had the opportunity to pull our resources together and have a family day, and I don't really think that it's going to happen this year considering the pandemic. I came across your post about three things that we can do, or three things that would keep children from being involved in gangs. And I went kind of dark there, you know, because we have some real deep-seated issues within our community. The previous caller talked about the parent, the struggling parent, and because, I mean, when all the chips are laid out, it is on the parents of the children to pass on all of the qualities that that's going to be presented to the world, you know? Hmm. And so my children, they're not just my children, they're the absolute next generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we have a very huge responsibility in bringing forth the next generation. You know, and so now we just willy-nilly with it, you know. And so the biggest issue from my perspective is teen pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way on earth a 14-year-old has the ability, the skills to raise and rear the next generation. It just doesn't happen.
That's true.
So,
I saw your post about that. That was powerful.
Yeah, I mean, we really have to dig deep into this. You know, if we really, I mean, this is like, it's like our counseling. You know, we have to get this out and address, you know.
Right.
And so I was doing the math. And so
that's part of the show.
She talked about, she talked about the age of the parent and how the parent is struggling financially to be there for the child. Well, let's say the mother is 14 years old when she has the baby. That means she got pregnant when she was 13. Well, actually, let's be realistic. Let's be 15. And I posted a flyer that says that 15-year-old mothers are impregnated by men between the ages of 20 and 29.7 years old. Those are adults.
Yes.
Adults have absolutely no putting their hands and being sexual with a child at all. They can say all day long, and this might sound a little preachy, but they can say all day long, well, she wanted it. She can't give consent. She's a minor.
That's right.
You know, this is a big problem. This is a big problem.
And her parents are going to wind up raising both her and her child.
Yes.
And that creates an even bigger stress on an already impoverished situation. Poverty is not just financial. Poverty is a state of mind. Poverty is education. You know, how educated are we on our family issues, on our history, on our government?
You know,
this oppression is not just a financial thing.
Mm-mm.
You know, we're educationally oppressed.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so that lack of education,
as one of the chokeholds.
Right. Mm-hmm. It is. It absolutely is. And so that's kind of what I wanted to touch on, is just talking about that and understanding how important it is to reduce that, educate we have to educate our young people. We have to educate our young men. We have to educate our adolescents.
Yeah.
In the fatherhood research, they said that when a father is actively involved in their child's life, they're less likely to experience sexual abuse.
Mm.
And we know that fathers also, that incest goes on, but oftentimes it is that boyfriend, girlfriend, you know, coming in that increases the possibility of those things. So actively involving our fathers, it makes a difference all the way around and brings us right back to the role of the man and how that has basically led to the dismantling of the Black family, which trickled down to our future, our youth.
Absolutely. Parents forget sometimes that they are their children's first teacher. And what the child sees and learns is going to stick with them throughout their lives. I mean, a lot of us were raised by old school parents, and it was non-negotiable. You know, every house has to have rules. You know, you don't let trash, come in your house, and you definitely don't let it stay.
Right.
So Celeste, can I have you stay on the line? I want to bring in another caller. We're looking for Aaron Foster to call in. I just want to see if this caller may be him. Would you mind staying on?
All right.
Thank you. Caller 0913, you're on Dr. Harris' Black Lives Matter show.
Hello, caller.
Hello, caller, can you hear me? Okay, well, I'll check back in with caller 0913 in about a minute.
you know, instead I listened to the sister mentioning these older gentlemen who have impregnated younger women. And the thing about that is when you find this happening, that younger woman is out there looking for what she is missing at home. That's that father figure. And not saying that this is right, because God knows it is not. And virtually, basically, that is the crime that is occurring. But when that father is missing, they are out there searching.
I'm going to have to stop you right there. I'm going to have to stop you right there, because I think that is a mindset that has to be questioned. You know, whether she's missing something at home or not, it is absolutely unacceptable.
Yes, and that's absolutely what we're saying. It is unacceptable. And so, no one's saying that is acceptable. That should not be happening.
Think about her. Think about her being a 15-year-old mother. By the time she's 30 years old, she has a 15-year-old ready to get pregnant and have another baby.
So this is
an absolutely absolute generational ill.
Right.
It has to be addressed.
Exactly.
And whether it's and it can be someone that is in her age group. Still, I think that there is a time for that. They have so much time to become parents. It's something that has to be grown in them for parenting. You know, and so many things that they have in life that they can experience, that they have to experience. You know, so that we as a people can grow. You know,
exactly.
We depend on our generation to go out there.
We're talking about this because I remember, I think it had to be like 68, 69, when they started doing sex education in schools. And I remember that my mom was, you know, she allowed me to take the class, but she was up in arms because she said that is the parents' job to talk to their children about sexual relations. And I think a lot of times, you know, it's not just that the girl or the boy is looking for, that the girl's looking for a father figure. I think sometimes they're running from abuse in the home. And I'm saying that, you know, I know people who, you know, left home at 17 and 18 because of domestic violence. So I'm agreeing with you on that.
One good thing is that we have opportunities. You know, it would be different if we didn't have the opportunity to turn this thing around, but we do. You know, and that is taking the parents that we have and educating them on the responsibilities of being a parent. You know, and really having some very strong, comprehensive parenting programs. You know, identifying that. I had someone do that for me. You know, and it really helped me. It helped me realize a lot of things, you know, about what I had embarked upon as a parent. I had four children. Mm-hmm. I had four children by the time I was 25 years old.
Mm.
So, and right now, you know, I talk about this all the time. I don't have any grandchildren. You know, my children are, my oldest daughter is a doctor. And so it really helped me kind of channel myself, you know. I'm not anomaly out here, you know. I hit the streets.
Yeah.
I hit the streets as a parent. I was a young parent, and sitting down wasn't in my forte. You know, but I had to come to the conclusion that somebody had to be responsible for the children, and that somebody had to be me.
Right.
Parenting
is a full-time job. It is a full-time job,
24/7. Well, I'm going to bring in another caller, but right before I do, you said, you know, parenting classes, and I know what that did for me. I didn't take parenting classes per se, but I was in college and I took child development classes. And it helped me understand a lot. It helped me understand that those tantrums wasn't because my kid was trying to be a brat. It's because their brain could not grasp they were just kind of like, I can't get it out. I can't express it the way that for you to understand, because, you know, the brain development, how trauma affects children into adulthood. So I really think just even a basic of understanding the development and stages of a child, so the parents know how to deal with it. And like our last caller, Christine, talked about, is setting those boundaries, not being the friend and being consistent. So I'm going to see who this caller is and bring this caller in.
Okay.
Caller 8305, can you hear me?
Hello, yes, can you hear me?
Yes, yes. We have Celeste on the call. We're going to see if she has some things that she wants to talk about still, and then we'll bring you on in. This is Sister Crystal?
Yes, hello. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening. Okay, Celeste, did you were you about to say something? I didn't want to cut you off, but I just wanted to bring the caller in.
Yeah, just one last thing. I usually, when I talk to young parents and, you know, just the young women, even in my family, I always recommend a couple books. It's one by Masnish, I think her name is Masnish and Faber, and I'll post it on that post so that they can see the book. It's called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. And it's also another by Carol Tribe called Theories. And it talks about how children develop and what they need in order to actualize, like trust versus mistrust and stuff like that. And those things can be really common knowledge for people that'll help them with being a parent and understanding the roles and responsibilities of that. I just want to end this conversation with thank you for having me. I look forward to whatever we're doing in the community. Keep me in the loop. And I appreciate everything that you all are doing. It means so much to me.
Thank you, Celeste. Thank you for coming in. You always are rooting for me, and I appreciate that. And you've been there. You put in your time here in Fresno, even though you weren't born and raised here in Fresno. You still on the front line. Expose the stuff the way we like them to be exposed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Maria. Thank you, Eileen. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you,
sir. Have a good evening.
Okay. Good night.
Good night. So, Sister Crystal, what night did you got to drop on us tonight?
We know you got some.
Okay. Well, no, I just want to say this. You know, I heard some good stuff so far, and I know that this is a conversation that we will have to have again and again, because we have to put the words into action pretty soon. See what I'm saying?
Yes.
But I heard, I think her name was Christina, and she was talking about, you know, the overall family. And I work in the industry for over 25 years, and it does take the whole family to go through the process at the same time, which sometimes that's not possible. So when you address issues with a child and you get them to a state of normalcy and then you send them back to a sick household, then either they become sick or they run. Okay. You know, it's fight or flight. Mm-hmm. So if the whole family doesn't come to the understanding of the need for services, it could be mental health, it could be parenting, it could be education, whatever it is, then the person that's getting these services will start seeing how sick the family really is, you know. Mm-hmm. And it is good when a light comes on for somebody, but it also separates the family more, because now I'm starting to look at you a little different because something is wrong with you. You know, I thought it was just
right, right.
It's you and it's my brother and it's, you know, my uncle wasn't right either. You know what I'm saying? So then we start seeing what really went on in the family. And, you know, black families and Spanish families have something like what goes on in the house stays in the house. It stops them from getting help because you can't tell nobody. Because then here comes CPS. They're going to take all the children. Then the mom is going to be mad if he's told, and the daddy going to go to jail. It's just a big gamut to this, you know, getting healthy, I'm going to say. You know, when you start getting healthy, you start seeing the sickness a little different. So I like what she said when she said to educate and treat the whole family, because if the family's going to stay together, they're going to have to get well together. They got to get healthy together.
Exactly.
And if they're not, a lot of times they remove the children who really ain't sick because they children. And they leave the parents or the people caring for the children who are sick, and they don't get any treatment.
No help. Right. I love how you put that.
You know, Crystal, you bring up a point that Sister Maria talks about all the time, Band-Aid, or trying to put a Band-Aid when you need major surgery. And if the family needs major surgery, then that needs to happen because the Band-Aid ain't going to work.
Exactly.
Especially if you put the Band-Aid on.
And then the patient bleeds out all over the place.
That's
right. But what I say, too, when children are in school, as early as kindergarten, preschool, Head Start, you see signs of things going on. That's when it's time to be addressed. That's when it's time to start calling in the parent, the grandmother, the caregiver, and see what's going on. Because at that time, like my aunt would say, when it's a little twig, you can kind of bend it. But when it becomes a tree, you can't do nothing but kick at it. You understand?
Right.
So we have to get it when it's bendable, when it's pliable. And what I'm seeing in my industry is they have already became who they think they're going to be. God is good. He can do all things. But they have to get in a place where he can do his thing most of the time. And then we have to also look at, where are they going back to? You know, you don't go to the doctor and get surgery, get well, and then go back and let them reopen the wound.
Okay.
So sometimes we're sending our children back to where the sickness is, the cancer is, and they can't get well because they know where they're going back to.
Right.
So you do have to heal the whole family. At least the family parts is going to be of help to the child. You know, the ones that are going to be consistent, that's going to be in his life. If you ain't going to be there, then I understand. And see, I'm a realist. Everybody ain't meant to be a parent because they don't know how. They don't want to know how. So it wasn't meant for everyone, but these children didn't ask to get here. So it's meant for us to raise them up in the way they should go so when they're old, they won't depart and they can get healthy. So it takes a community. We have to, as a community, step up for these children that can't step up for themselves. I love y'all. Hey, Sister Aileen.
Hey,
I love you, Sister Maria. You're doing a wonderful job. And my brother back there, I love you guys.
Thank you.
We love you, too.
Love you back. You know, Sister Crystal brings up something that is so important. I'm just going to say this, and I'm trying to listen to what everybody's saying, but it's so important for children to be children. So many times our children are taking on things that children shouldn't even have to deal with.
So
you know, feeding their little brothers and sisters, keeping the house clean, going to school, getting their schoolwork done, making sure the clothes are clean for themselves and their siblings. You know, that's a parent's job. You know, it's one thing to have a child have chores, but, you know, it's not cool for the child to have to be a grown-up.
No, it is not.
It's important to be mindful of that.
Well, unfortunately, today's society now, I think it kind of reached this thing to where it became where you no longer can have anything to say to my child. Remember when everybody started coming in with that mess? You shouldn't have anything to say to my kid. But sometimes those on the outside can actually see what's going on because those on the inside have put up blinders and put on shades. And it's like, well, I'm so used to this happening. And
it takes a village.
It really does take a village. Whether people's
A healthy village.
A healthy village at that. You know, you just say what you want. I remember all dudes in my neighborhood growing up. Old man used to get pissed off because you stepped on his grass. But that old man.
That was my dad.
But that old man has some knowledge for you. You know, back in the day, growing up in my time, you learned to respect the old folks in your neighborhood. Because the old folks in your neighborhood, whether you realize it or not, they would drop some signs on you.
And that included the
wine holes
on the corner.
That included the wine holes on the corner.
Everything
in the neighborhood.
Coming over. Yeah, they was there over there and they wasn't supposed to be there. Yes. It was checks and balances.
It really was.
We didn't have the same kind of chokeholds then that we have now. And why is that? Because we were looking out for one another. And so we need some of that now. And not be so quick to just jump to the conclusion that it's all negative when somebody speaks to you about your child. You should just be open and say, well, you know what? I appreciate you sharing that with me. And just leave it at that without getting all nasty about it. But our children, we have to invest. And that's one of the things that we do at Freedom School. We talk to them not just about agriculture and sewing and all these things. We also talk about the history of Africans and the history of Africans in this country so that they know they have a solid foundation. They don't need to get a solid foundation. They have a culture. They don't need to acquire a culture. And so one of the things that Brother Tony's always saying is that, you know, in America, they love black culture, but they don't like black people. And it's true. We have everything that we need to get out of the chokeholds that have been put on us, and we have tolerated the ones that we can change. And I was just sharing with folks, and some of you may already have heard this, that California is looking to dismantle their juvenile prison system.
Yeah.
And if that is true, that's going to be a big boom for our children, and so we need to get ready for that.
Yes, because the bottom line is this, folks. If we get ready, we on top of this. If you stay ready, you ain't got to get ready.
That's true.
Okay? One of the things that we have done ourselves, in all honesty, is that we have dropped the ball and have yet to pick it back up. Because we might do what other folks are thinking about us. And that's something we have to stop and stop soon. Otherwise, we're going to perish.
We can't have that. So we're I'm hoping that our founder, Reverend Floyd Harris, is gonna come and drop some knowledge. I've been trying to get him to come and sit in my chair and he's like, No. But he's gonna have to come and do it.
Yeah, he's gonna have to speak on it today.
He's gonna have to come and do it. Yeah, you got to get up.
Just slide on in here, young.
So yesterday I just put out a little post on Facebook. And this is some of the feedback I got. You know, I just asked, you know, what are a few things that would stop or prevent youth from joining gangs or engaging in criminal activity? So I got a lot of responses from Tony, access to the arts and in nature. Family always plays a role, but minority children rarely have access to the same things that their white schoolmates do. And then we have Bonnie Lee. She worked at Boys and Girls Club with me on some things. And she said, in the words of Whitney, teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride. And pride for children is really important because it makes them feel like they're competent. And so when I worked for Boys and Girls Club for a number of years, worked with some wonderful people that are still there, Anna Bautista, Maria Garcia, Tasma Scott, Cedric Ayers,
so many people. But we invested in a strategy called Buick, B-U-I-C, and we use that in gang intervention to draw in the family members. We did a whole family approach also, and to engage the young folks. And they said that when you implement these four components, it often prevents youth from joining the gang. But like Christina Yee said, it has to be consistent. It has to be ongoing. And that's providing youth a sense of belonging for the B, a sense of usefulness, a sense of influence and competence. So those are the components that the gangs give them. They make them feel like they belong, they have a purpose, they're useful, and that they're diligent in carrying out whatever the aims of that gang may be. So that was the appeal. And to this day, I learned that about 15 years ago, but to this day, I still use it because I still, of course, work with gang-involved youth, the families of gang-involved youth, or just youth that have been through trauma and come from low socioeconomic backgrounds, and mainly youth of color. So that is one thing that I still implement. So we have our founder, Black Lives Matter founder, and he has been directing behind the scenes and helping us move to that higher level. He always demands excellence, and he will put in the work himself to model what excellence looks like and what it takes to build up to excellence. So we just want to bring him in, and we definitely want to get his thoughts. Since he lets us take over his show every Tuesday.
Well, you know, thank you for having me. I don't know why y'all want me to come speak.
All
this knowledge. I ain't sitting over here with Huey P. Newton shirt on. And I'm like, oh my God. So I'm just working the lights. You know, sweep on the floor.
But you are so much more than that.
You make it happen, and you just have to
make
accept
it happen.
That.
Yes, make
and
it happen.
You have to live with that dog. You make it happen. You know, and I'm going to be honest with you. You know, when I first came back to Fresno, Sister Reed put it in my ear, you know, you're going to have to meet this brother because, you know, he got some things going on. I think kids like him. And to be honest, for me, it has been a very pleasant experience because I'm going to tell you honestly, I don't tolerate food, and I have a real problem with Black men dropping the ball, even though we can be fair about all of us from time to time.
And you're progressive.
And I've been told I'm progressive, but the bottom line is if you're standing up for what's right and you're standing up for my folks, I got your back. I'm there for you.
You know, somebody, I don't know who said it, Aileen, Brother Pennybrook. I think it was Aileen who said that the blueprint of our liberation has already been done.
Man.
It's already been set in stone in writing. History is there.
Is there.
And, you know, our ancestors, you know, they have shown us the blueprint. Liberation, justice, freedom, and equality. I think from my perspective, what is happening in America, and I'll be 50 August 24th, Lord willing. And so you all notice that my hair is not cut. Most people used to see me a straight line and all that. So,
right.
I'm 50 years old, I'm halfway to 100, and I'm going to get dreadlocks now. So I'm working on getting dreadlocks.
All right now. Oh,
I did the Jerry Curl thing. I tried to go back and do that. People just had a fit.
I let it go.
Jerry Curl days go. I'm going to do this. My point is that we're in a hell of a time right now.
Oh, yeah.
And Fresno, especially in America. And I think that there's an old saying, do for self or be a slave.
Amen.
And I think people get a joy in trying to think for black people. When we are the original people.
Exactly.
Now, if I was at church, my organist would be playing right now.
Right, right.
And I think that it comes a point in time where we have to call a spade a spade a spade.
Oh, yeah.
And understand that we have to take over now. We just have to take over now.
Right.
Because we're under the eight ball. And all spectrums of this whole world right now.
So far behind us, so far.
I was listening to Celeste as she speak. Thank you for calling in, my sister. Think it was Celeste who told us about Mary Brown, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Celeste.
That's a sister that's on her post, watching what's going on.
Seeing what's happening.
In her community.
Yes.
That's the type of people that I like hanging around. Those are the type of people that's blowing a bugle and say, hey, something is going down
in the
neighborhood. You know, let's get on it. And when I got the call, we got on it. You see what I'm saying? So I think that when we look at how in this epidemic now, virus, and while we're in it, we have black men being murdered and lynched all over.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. On a daily basis.
I listened to a sister last week or this week. I think I sent it to somebody. And she said, I'm tired of marching.
Mm-hmm.
One brother said, no disrespect, but I'm tired of praying. We're tired of holding signs.
Exactly.
We're tired of our young black men dying. Mm-hmm. So we have to do something different.
Yeah.
And what the difference is in the South is, our black people are walking around with guns now.
Yeah.
To send a message to those police departments, white supremacy, Ku Klux Klan, that were tired of being sick and tired, as Fannie Lou Hamer said.
Yeah.
And now we're going to move into action. Now, we understand that Reagan, with his scary self, made him rest in peace.
Mm.
He was the one who pushed legislation in California.
This is true.
Because the Black Panther Party wasn't thugs.
Nope.
There was not hooligans.
Nope.
There were very educated men and women knew how to read.
Who knew how to read.
The old saying was, you want to hide something from a Negro, put it in a book.
Exactly.
See, the Black Panthers wasn't scared to read or the Constitution.
No, they weren't.
Because you have to understand that when the Constitution was written, black people had nothing to say about it.
None whatsoever.
As a matter of fact, we're taking out the trash and bringing the food to the table for them to make the Constitution. So the Constitution was created against us.
Of course.
And so when you write legislation and white policy that black people is 3/5 of a human being.
Say that.
These were white folks that did that.
Yeah.
So their white privilege for them to continue because, see, they knew they were going to have kids.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
And we're dealing with their children now.
Yeah, that's right.
Great, 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 great grandchildren, great grandchildren now who is keeping a legacy of their grandpa. Great grandpa, ideology going.
Well, yeah, let's pass that white privilege on.
Ancestor children or friends.
Exactly.
So when we look at United Snakes of America, there's nothing united about it.
No, what's what?
There's nothing united about United Snakes of America.
No,
what we're dealing with is snakes.
Exactly.
Huh? Yes. Now, if they come in here right now, we're on the ground, I bet you all the women will jump on all the screen. Jump out the window, and I'm jumping on my back, and all the turn back,
but
not the computer.
I get the
snake. You kill the snake. What are you doing to snake? You kill the snake.
Kill the snake.
So our brothers in the South are saying, we're tired of being sick and tired, and we're going to take things in our own hands now.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So the Black Panther Party has the blueprint.
Yes.
See, we as black people in California, we don't have a lot of high numbers, but we have allies.
I think
that we need to push legislation so that we can have the right to bear arms, too, because the U.S. Constitution said that we could.
Exactly.
But if it said that we could, how can we let one white boy named Reagan is dead decide that we can sit up here and can't carry on?
Yes.
You
don't have no problem with
it. You mean to tell me that we're going to expect the police department to protect and serve us?
I was about to say, how you going to expect folks to protect you? They the ones doing it.
Now, EOC, bless their heart. The lunch program came back.
Look at
the shirt you have on right
here.
I took pictures of it.
Stokely Carmichael, all them brothers. Yeah.
Stokely Carmichael, all of them had a vision for black people.
Yeah, they did.
And black ones.
And they pushed it for us.
Yeah.
Yes. Angela Davis.
And they accomplished a lot.
But we allowed the narrative to be changed by the white government to say that they were thugs.
They were criminals.
It took all government
in order to do it.
To bring them down.
So when we start talking about our youth, and you said it earlier about the Freedom School, we educate, motivate, energize, organize, and mobilize, and take them to our
higher level.
We said a higher level.
Yes.
How do you take them to a higher level? You let them know that they are kings and queens,
exactly,
and where they come from and what their ancestors had accomplished and built this whole nation.
That's right.
Exactly.
They don't have to be ashamed of nothing.
Nothing.
We walk around with our heads up, not down.
Mm-hmm.
Because we come from a people of richness.
There you go.
We come from a people of that was inventors of this whole country.
Mm-hmm.
So when everyone here listening on this live stream, please share it. Let them know that whatever they driving, touching, using, black folks invented.
Oh yeah.
So when you go to the bathroom in the morning, at night, or you got an upset stomach and you sitting on that toilet, no, a black man created the toilet. Now, he created it. Why did they paint it black? They painted the toilet white. But it was created by a black. See, everything was stripped from us. Okay? So we got to go back to basics right now.
Yes.
See, the black man got to stop being a scary man. So you can't be the Wizard of Oz in a revolution.
You cannot.
You just can't do it.
You cannot.
Well,
that's why most folks don't like me, because I'm not a character of the Wizard of Oz. See, we got too many Wizard of Oz in this country, especially in Fresno.
Hey.
We got most sisters. Now, I tell sisters, let's strap up and bear on. It's a different
culture.
in the South than it is on the West Coast.
Right.
Now, I'm not putting all black people down. I'm just talking about the culture right now.
Yes.
When you get off the plane, it just feels different. You walk through the airport, you're seeing all black pictures of the university and this, this. I'm not looking at Reagan and Bush and all the other stuff. You get a sense of pride. Then you go to the college. Everything you see is black.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying ain't no white folks there. But the majority of almost 90% or 9% of folks that's black.
Right.
The young people. Yes, sir. No, sir.
Right.
Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. No, we don't get that on the West Coast. We were talking about parenting earlier. I think so. That's what y'all were talking about, parenting. It starts at home. It does start at home.
Yeah, that's generation.
It starts at home. And so my son, he's about this tall, going to some school by Roosevelt. Every morning, I would have him get out the car. Now, his mama was sitting over there in the passenger. He would come to the car, so I'd open the door. He would sit on, he'd just lay his head on my leg. He was in a school that had no black people, not even a janitor who cleaned the floors and the toilet. It was all the same. Now, we talk about putting our children inside institutions. That doesn't even represent me. So how I want to be liked if there's nobody there to be liked?
Right.
So exactly. All the other children, looking at this one little black kid, like, really, you look different from us. But it was my job as a father, despite what his mother thought, no disrespect to the woman, but it was my job to make sure and understood that my son was going inside of an institution.
Yes.
That had no pictures of Dr. King, Malcolm X, nobody. So I told him, I said, who are you? He said, I'm Floyd E. Henderson. I said, what is your response? Now you just, in fourth grade. I said, what is your responsibility? To protect the black woman. To protect the black community. No justice. No peace. So I'm teaching him that at a young age.
Yeah.
I said, what do we want? He says, justice. I said, what do we want? It now.
Exactly.
See, I'm planting a seed in him right now.
Right.
Yeah.
I said, long live the gorilla. Black power. He said, black power.
Hey.
I said, you're a leader? He said, not a follower.
Exactly.
So when we start talking about loving our children, our babies, we have to let them know that they're leaders
at a young age.
And when he went into that school, there was something that came out of him that the other children didn't know I put in him. Leadership.
If you stay ready, so you ain't got to get ready.
Now, the other children see that my little son had leadership capabilities.
Right.
So he became the line monitor. Yeah. So one day, he came home and said, Dad, he said, the kids, they just won't get in line. I said, really? He said, yeah. And he was feeling kind of down. I said, well, I'll tell you what you do. I said, you stand strong. Hold your head back.
Exactly.
Because he had a lot coming at him.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you walk up to the person, and I said, you take your little finger like this, yeah, a little bit of your finger. And I said, you take it, you put it in the air, and you kind of walk away, and come back like that. Get it on. And he said it worked.
They got it.
So ever since then, everywhere he goes, he's a leader now.
Yes.
Even at Central, you know, awesome.
Yes.
Number one, chilling in the whole South team by State of California.
Yes.
And he's in Southern University, the start of something. Right, right. Now the football team is getting upset because of the new team that he didn't start.
Oh, well.
So now he's, but he's in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So my point is that to love our babies, we have to teach them excellence.
It is our job.
But we, as adults, just can't talk it.
Right.
We have to walk it. You got to walk it.
Yeah.
And you have to be consistent. And you have to be transparent.
Yeah.
And there's no more damn excuses. Sorry, I'm no more excuses.
None.
No more excuses for our community and our babies.
No.
Yeah. Because if we don't put nothing in here, then why would we expect something else? So every Freedom School student that came through our school, we reposted pictures from last year. I seen all those pictures and said, look at all these babies.
Hey.
They have taken the Freedom School fever, as Eileen always
said.
And their parents. We built a nation.
Yes.
We built a program. And wherever those children are right now, they will never forget the seed. They will never forget the relationships. They will never forget the sewing class.
Remember the student that came back, the college student that came back that went to that work. Five, six colleges from HBC came back to Freedom School to talk about their experience at Freedom School and what they learned and what they're moving forward with. I mean, it's powerful. So we need Freedom School boosters. So anybody else want to be a Freedom School booster? Come on, we go to work.
But see, that's what's important. It is important to raise up those who go forth. For example, your children at these HBCs.
Yeah.
Because one of the problems I always had living on the West Coast was the connection to the HBCs.
Yeah,
the
disconnect.
Yeah, definitely.
Like you, like Pastor was saying, the atmosphere is different. Yes, the atmosphere is different. But see, the other side of that coin is, yes, you get off and they have this, that, and the other representing that school. Black folks here, black folks there, but you always got to remember, still the seat of that power is that snake we dealing with. He gonna let that school be, because that keeps us away from
his school.
Okay? There's a method to the madness. Okay? There's a method to the madness. But it is up to us to make that madness a whole lot stronger than what you think it is. Take it to all different levels. Like Flying Family Stone used to say, we want to take it higher. That's what we're going to do.
Yes.
We accept the Freedom School kids, all the babies.
Yes.
No matter what they
hey.
What problems they had, personal problems.
Right.
We welcome them with open arms.
Yep.
And the children, police, I use police.
In a good way. In the right way. In the right way.
Self-governed. Because the leadership of the Freedom School staff board so involved in these children. We're on the emergency cards of school. We just don't run a safety
policy.
We're year-round involved in these children's lives right now.
Hey.
We went into classrooms. We talked to the teachers. We talked to the principal. I've been parents
that
called me to come to their house with the kids and got out of control. But my point is that we are involved in our children. And our children, when other children come to school and they don't have the right behavior, what do they tell them? What do the students tell them?
Like, we don't talk to the staff like that here. We don't treat each other like that here. And don't make us go get rubber hands.
But see, that's a beautiful thing, because they are learning. Hey, there's a certain calm here that we like, and we're going to keep it that way.
We have respect for one another.
We respect one another.
Right. Yeah. We give respect to get respect.
Exactly.
And that's what we're supposed to do, to teach our children. All of our children, we love them. Some fall off, we go check on them, you know. And so when we start talking about loving our babies, our youth, you know, Freedom School is a game.
Yeah, the good kind of gang. Right. And gather. And gather together. So I have a caller who's been on the line just patiently waiting. So hi, caller 2257. Can you hear me? Caller 2257.
Okay. Twice.
Going once? Twice? Just listening. I just wanted to just read a little excerpt and then show a short 5-minute video as we wind the show down. So this article is titled, it said, "The Black Age of Mass Incarceration. American politicians are now eager to disown a failed criminal justice system that's left the U.S. with the largest incarcerated population in the world. But they failed to reckon with history. 50 years after Daniel Patrick Monahan's report, The Negro Family, tragically helped create the system, it's time to reclaim his original intent." So I believe they wanted to quiet this man because after I read over what he was writing about, it's dead on to what we're going through. By his own lights, Daniel Patrick Monahan, ambassador, senator, sociologist, and intern American intellectual, was a product of a broken home and a pathological family. He was born in 1927 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but raised mostly in New York City. When Monahan was 10 years old, his father, John, left the family, plunging it in poverty. Monahan's mother, Margaret, remarried, had another child, divorced, moved to Indiana to stay with relatives, then returned to New York where she worked as a nurse. Am I saying the last name right? Moynihan's childhood, a tangle of poverty, remarriage, relocation, single motherhood, contrasted starkly with the idyllic American family life he would later evolve. "My relations are obviously those of divided allegiance," Moynihan wrote in a diary that he kept during the 1950s. As a teenager, Monahan divided his time between his studies and working at the docks in Manhattan to help his family. I'm going to just scroll down a little because I want to get to the meat of this, of what he did.
Oh, Daniel. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so influenced by the Civil Rights Movement, Moynihan focused on the Black family. He believed that an undue optimism about the pending passage of civil rights legislation was obscuring a pressing problem, a deficit of employed Black men of strong character. He believed that this deficit went a long way towards explaining African American communities' relative poverty. Moynihan began searching for a way to press the point with the Johnson administration. I felt I had to write a paper about the Negro family, Moynihan later recalled, to explain to the fellows how there was a problem more difficult than they knew. The report, called The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, unsigned, it was meant to be an internal government document with only one copy distributed at first and the other 99 kept in the locked vault. Running into the tide of optimism around civil rights, the Negro family argued that federal government was underestimating the damage done to Black families by three centuries of sometimes unimaginable mistreatment, as well as racist virus in the American bloodstream, which would continue to plague Black families in the future. So that's just a little
piece of the article. I attached the article if you want to read it in detail. It's by the Atlantic. And, you know, it just really stood out that the things that he was saying are things that we are still going through. And he also said that they said that Monahan believed that the core of all the problems lay in the black family structure was mutated by white oppression. So we already have covered that on every show, how slavery, white oppression, the dismantling of the black family, the forcing black men to be broken and submit, have led to current day situation. And a lot of people, you know, want to say, well, you know what, we can't keep on dragging that up. We can't keep on blaming things on that. Well, we need to know the root of the problem. If we don't know the root of the problem, then we treat what's on the top, but we never get to the root, where the real damage is. And, you know, we have to treat that. So slavery and oppression and racism has led to the dismantling of the family, dismantling of the man, which have effects to this very day. And that's why we're doing this show right now, is to, you know, start rebuilding, changing that narrative, and talking about things we can do. We always want an action to take away. And I asked Christina, you know, what can we do right now? And she said something that we always talk about, that conversation. Those conversations are important with each other. Those conversations are important with our children. Those conversations are important in our households, at the table. Those conversations are important out in politics.
Yes.
Those conversations are important to rebuild our and reclaim our communities. And so, you know, sitting at the table one night a week, just one night a week,
exactly,
just to be able to communicate and talk and have that conversation with your kids so you can gouge their temperature. They can gouge your temperature, mm-hmm, because kids also know when their parents are not feeling some kind of way. We don't just observe our kids. Our kids actually observe us more than we observe them.
And now is the perfect time to do it during the pandemic.
You know. Yeah. You know, one of the things with my son and my daughter, even right now, I talked to him today as well. As black men, we're some, not all, they are, we're masculine. We have this tough side of us that's, you know, we don't cry, we don't see daddy cry. See the side that we do it publicly. We hurt publicly. And that bothers people,
mm-hmm,
because we show affection towards one another.
That's true.
It has nothing to do with us being gay or just, it's just we show affection towards you and my daughter. But I talk to every time we talk about one another. Because
I want to play. I want to interrupt something, but
yeah.
we'll interrupt Eileen, but
that's okay. Love is important action. We need to show more of it to another, whether it be our children, our elders, all of our brothers and sisters. That's love is an action, y'all.
You know, my mother knows who. But one of the things that she insists on, when you wake up in the morning, somebody find somebody, hey, good morning, how you doing?
That
goes down my household.
Yes.
Don't care, mom, how you doing? How you dressed?
Mm-hmm.
When my sisters get up, hey, baby, how y'all doing?
This is an action.
When my niece, my great niece, my brother.
Yes. Yes.
You know, your friend, she said that, you know, family should sit down, we sit down.
Yes.
We've always sat down. And that's a generational thing.
It is.
Because one of the things I have learned, you do what you are taught. Back in the day, my grandmother was, come here, boy. What was your day like?
Yeah.
You better be able to break it down to her and let her know what your day was like. Because some old folks.
Oh, yes.
Was a whole different breed.
Oh, yeah. He has kids. I'm wrong. About having a meal, I used to think about the Sunday dinners that my mom used to make. And my dad was a big guy and a construction worker for like 30 years.
Okay.
And he couldn't have a regular plate. He needed a platter.
Yeah.
And, my sisters and I was sitting there like, can't eat all that. And then, like, 30 minutes later, all the food is gone from the plate. I'm like, you know, but. And check in with each other. Well, how was church today? What did y'all learn today? With choir thing, you know, and all these kind of things. And, you know, who got the Holy Ghost?
I remember, and it's funny when you think about this, but I remember when Jensen and Pigart, which was down D Street, actually had a chicken ranch here in Fresno. Because three of my uncles worked there.
Okay.
But I can remember on Sundays, you know, all my uncles would come over, you know, everybody get together, my cousins come over. Mm-hmm. Sunday dinner was like, you saw your cousins, you saw your uncles, your aunts, everybody got together. Them folks talked about what went on during the week. Kids got together and we ran like crazy and played in the backyard and went nuts.
See? Remember that who was that movie, Soul Food?
Mm-hmm.
Well, every Sunday.
But that's what goes on in the Black neighborhood.
During this pandemic, I asked my kids, like, what is the thing that they miss the most? And they said being around their grandmother and their cousins you know, birthdays and celebrations and church.
Yeah. It's a family thing.
Okay, so I finally got this video to come up, and it's from Gateways, and it's a college who offered a program in a youth prison in Washington, and they basically learned from one another. So this is the story, short story of one of the participants of that program, and his name is Christian, I believe. So I'm just going to reposition the camera to show the video. About 10 minutes.
I learned how to do this in Green Hill. Man, I used to trade these, like, I braid your hair for some cup noodles and some chips or deodorant or something. It's my hustle. And I did it on myself. Man, it took...
This is my friend Christian. When he was a teenager, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison. While he was there, he signed up for Gateways for Incarcerated Youth, a college class that allows students and incarcerated youth to learn alongside each other at Green Hill, a juvenile detention facility in Washington State. After his release, he enrolled at Evergreen and took Gateways as a full-time student, which is where I met him.
I'm Christian, a.k.a. CJ. I'm from here from the Central District, and this is Cherry. MLK is really significant to me. Everybody from the hood would come here CD, this is like the safe haven for everybody. Right here. I'm him up and scary. I joined the gang because I didn't have a family growing up, and they just offered me that family shit. I went to Garfield on 23rd and Cherry. That's my high school. I didn't graduate there because I went to Green Hill. It made me realize that my life has just been frozen. I'm not experiencing nothing that a regular teenager should experience. Prom and, you know, actually graduating with everybody, like class of 2012 and stuff like that. I got robbed of, like, all those stuff. I mean, like, jobs. I didn't get to, you know, experience at 16. Yeah, I can work now, you know what I mean? Wow, I can have a driver's permit and teach myself how to drive with somebody else, like, those things. Doing what I want, eat whatever I want, you know what I'm saying? Talk to whoever I want. Every time I would see someone from Evergreen come in, it was like, extra good that, okay, maybe I can get that or I can get there. They helped me, like, realize that there's other things out there in the world than, you know, living a criminal lifestyle. Like, being in college has empowered me to be a better person, if that, like, makes any sense. Something will confront me in the institution, like a fight or something, and I got to avoid it. I'll go back to work and pray to God about it. Like, God, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm trying to get out. I'm trying to be better. You know what I'm saying? Just give me strength to say no and to surround myself with other people. I've met some really spiritual people in there. I've met, like, really kind-hearted people that want to change. It's like kind-hearted people that make mistakes just like everybody else. Like, human. So you make a mistake in the office or at work. You know what I'm saying? I just made a mistake in life. Just to treat us to mistakes. When I got out the first time, oh, so I got some teriyaki. You know what I'm saying? I went to some mall. It was like, oh, my God. I just was like, man, I'm free. I'm going to do everything now. It's about time. Like, everything I just wanted to do within those 5 years, I was trying to make up for it.
The fall after Christian finished his first sentence, he enrolled at Evergreen, where he continued his involvement with Gateways from the Outside. Later that winter, he was arrested and sent back to Green Hill for a couple of months.
You're like a chosen number to be incarcerated again. It was like an understanding that I couldn't fully accept it. I ended up getting locked up again when I was in the Gateways class. Like, I got sent back from Evergreen back to Green Hill, and like, that was always on my mind, like, every night, recidivism. Like, I'm already a number picked out in society. Like, that was the hardest little chunk of time I ever did. I did 5 years, and then the 6 months I did was just crazy to me.